Welcome to Betrayal Recovery Radio, the official podcast of APSATS, the Association of Partners of Sex Addict Trauma Specialists, hosted by Dr. Jake Porter. APSATS is a nonprofit organization providing professional training and compassionate support to partners affected by problematic sexual behavior and betrayal trauma. In each episode, Dr. Jake guides a conversation of enlightening insights and practical tools to empower those affected by sex addiction and betrayal trauma to use their voices and live their values. The mission of Betrayal Recovery Radio is to offer hope to those in need of healing and growth to those moving through grief. And now, here's your host, Dr. Jake Porter.
Welcome to another episode of Betrayal Recovery Radio. I am Dr. Jake Porter. When your partner has a sexual addiction, acting out is part of what defines that addiction. Dealing with it is hard. Even learning about it can be traumatic. But what about the behaviors inside the relationship? How do you recognize and respond to inappropriate treatment from your partner? How do you become personally and relationally healthier when at least some of the trauma you find yourself experiencing is due to your partner's behaviors inside the relationship? Whether overt or covert, whether emotional, psychological, sexual, or physical, considering the health of the patterns within the relationship can add another layer of complexity when looking at partners struggling with sex addiction. And yet, it is so necessary to take a deeper look at what is happening in order to understand and serve women and men impacted by addiction. Today, to talk about this important subject, I'm going to be joined by Kimberly Day. Kim is an APSATS licensed mental health counselor in the state of Washington, and her focus is in betrayal, trauma, and abuse. Kimberly has her own story around both of these themes, which is what has ignited her curiosity in uncovering and understanding the often overlooked complex patterns that exist within relationships and her passion for aiding and empowering women in their healing journey. But her number one job is being the mom of four kiddos. She loves chocolate ice cream, and naps. She dislikes potty training, calls to poison control, and doing the dishes late at night. I was so pleased with my conversation with Kim, and I know you're going to get a lot out of it. Before we turn our attention there, though, I do just want to remind you of some upcoming events sponsored by APSATS, the Association of Partners of Sex Addict Trauma Specialists. Coming up on September the 1st, a one-hour webinar from Kim Hansen Petroni, who is an APSATS certified coach and coach consultant supervisor. Her workshop is titled The Partner's Role in Couples Work. And then later in the month of September, Jessica Edens, an APSATS board member, will be doing her two-day program, September 28th and 29th, Betrayed Families, Support for Children and Families, a training for professionals who support folks impacted by sexual addiction. On October 20th through the 22nd, back by popular demand, Dan Drake and Janice Cottle will be offering their Restoring Truth Disclosure Guide training, a training that has gotten rave reviews. And then two more big events I want to make sure that you're aware of. November 1st through the 3rd, the annual APSATS conference will be held online. There are going to be incredible speakers, and I'll be there too as one of the speakers. It's going to be a wonderful day for both professionals, and there will be offerings for those who've been impacted by sex addiction as well. And then if you are a professional, whether that's a clinician or a coach who works with individuals who are impacted by betrayal trauma, or maybe you're a coach working with this population, need you to check out our online training, the Multidimensional Partner Trauma Model Training, which will be, that's the foundational training of APSATS, going to be offered online via Zoom during those days. All right. Lots of good stuff coming up. Check it all out at APSATS.org. And for now, let's turn our attention to our conversation with Kim. Well, hello, Kim. Welcome to Betrayal Recovery Radio.
Hello. I am excited to be here. It's nice to meet you, Jake.
It is good to meet you too. I'm excited about our time together and what we're going to be talking about. First thing though, you know, I've done a formal bio of you. Why don't you just take a minute to introduce yourself though, and what should our listeners know about you that you think is really important? What really matters about Kim Day?
I am a counselor in the state of Washington. Mm-hmm. My specialty is betrayal trauma and also relationship dynamics. Call them, when there is destructive and confusing patterns in the relationship. When that's tied to sexual addiction, and also when it's not. I am currently the director of the WORTH program, which is a betrayal trauma support program as part of Life Changing Services. And I've got 4 awesome, amazing kids.
So I want to start at the beginning, right? So many of us we're familiar with the idea that partners who've discovered betrayal experience very significant PTSD-like symptoms, right? They're in their own trauma in their relationship with a newly discovered sex addict. Let's just start with what you've seen that look like. You know, what does that look like?
We're talking, what does the trauma of the discovery look at? Yeah. If we were to go at in time, right when things essentially yes. get the fan, that discovery yes. or the disclosure initially.
Right. Right early on, yes.
There are a lot of ways. Usually it's not pretty. That trauma can manifest it for the woman we're talking about. Mm-hmm.
Okay. Yes, yes.
Yeah.
For the betrayed partner, who's not always a woman, but often
absolutely true. Pronouns. Usually there's an overall feeling of just a loss of groundedness in life. I thought I knew what was going on in my life. I thought I knew it was real, and now I'm not sure. And usually that can trickle into a lot of different areas. There can be hypervigilance. There can be avoidance of lived experiences that can be avoiding going certain places. There's usually a lack of trust, understandably, in the partner. There is a period of time of them trying to figure out what really is real and to replace that schema of this is what my life was like with something that's more accurate. There can be a lot of emotion and they run the gamut.
Yeah.
Obviously, it can be anger, depression, sadness, and the intensity is usually pretty extreme, oftentimes to a point where it can scare that betrayed partner. They can feel really overwhelmed in their own experience, a lack of trust of self, a lack of sense of their own identity, oftentimes of, if I didn't know who he was, now I'm not sure who I am, wow. or I don't know how to trust myself or the world again. So those are just a few. We could spend a whole episode talking about what this experience looks and feels like, but right. that gives you a little bit of an idea to start.
Yeah. And how long do those initial symptoms last? And in your experience, what have you seen there?
It really varies. It varies depending on a lot of factors. It varies depending on the individual themselves, how quickly they can get into a state of where they can start getting healthy information and resources. It depends on their support system. It depends on the behavior of the addicted partner. And if there is a continual, what they often call like trickle disclosures,
right.
when there is bombshell after bombshell, that feeling can persist for years of always feeling a little bit off step or not knowing when the next shoe, the proverbial shoe, is going to drop, never feeling quite safe. So all of those factors play in. So it's hard to give you an exact time frame of how long those right. symptoms last.
Yeah. And this is going to bring us a little more closely to what we're going to spend the bulk of our time talking about. And that's that, and I heard you say it depends on a lot. There are a lot of factors. One of them, though, is around the individual who committed the betrayal mm-hmm. and whether that person gets in recovery or not. Mm-hmm. And sobriety can make a big difference in terms of safety and stabilization, right? So this is the APSATS podcast, and in the APSATS model, that three-phase model, safety, stabilization have to come first, right?
Yeah.
But what I want us to look at, and what I'm excited to talk to you about, is are there some issues around safety and stabilization that can prevent a betrayed partner from moving forward that are not tied to sobriety from acting out, or more traditionally what we would consider recovery?
Absolutely. Absolutely. And this is an area of passion for me, because I see it quite commonly where there are these other relationship patterns that are in existence within the relationship that makes it hard for the betrayed partner to feel safe and to get grounded. And oftentimes women will identify, because these discoveries are so acute, they will identify all of their trauma to relate to that, to acting out or a sexual addiction related experience. But oftentimes the more covert patterns, gaslighting or belittling or other things that are existing in the relationship are actually causing a significant amount of trauma for the woman that she's not always identifying. And they can perpetuate long past when supposedly the partner is achieved sobriety. And I see it relatively frequently where women are saying, why am I not getting better? Why am I not getting, why am I not healing? He is sober. He's supposedly sober. There often still is some doubt in that, but I don't feel any safer. They still tie it back to the acting out, where their trauma is tied to what is happening in real time. So yes, they think it's trauma from this past disclosure or acting out that they think is resolved. But because of the relationship patterns, and if those are destructive, confusing, or toxic, but they're going unrecognized, unacknowledged.
Right.
They seem somewhat normal. Maybe the relationship has always existed in that kind of frame. Then women have a hard time recognizing why they're not healing and being able to move forward.
Yes, thank you. And even as I'm listening to you, thinking about different couples I've worked with where I've definitely seen those patterns emerge. And one of the ways I've seen this play out is maybe initially after discovery happens, let's say it's the husband who did the acting out and the wife who's been betrayed. Initially, the husband is on his best behavior, right? Mm-hmm. He's going to act right, and he's really trying hard, and he's been humbled by this discovery and gets into a 12-step program or this or that and may achieve some sobriety. Mm-hmm. But months go by, and then old behaviors begin to creep in.
Yes.
And the partner assumes that means he's lost his sobriety.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Because in her mind, when he got sober, that went away for a while. So yes, it's perfectly logical, but that's not necessarily the case. Is that right?
Yes, absolutely. There's so many varieties of the story that you shared, but that sense of I'm not sure what to trust, and that sense of chaos about what is real. Mm. Is it tied to acting out? Or is it tied to something else? The self-doubt, those are always flags for me when women start expressing that, to really dig deeper and get curious about more than just, is he acting out or is he not? It's common when we identify, okay, sexual addiction has been or is a problem, to kind of fixate on that. Okay, that's the problem in our marriage. Is it happening or is it not? Is it happening or is it not?
Yeah.
And it can put blinders on a betrayed partner from seeing the full scope of other dynamics, patterns, and issues in the relationship. And it can make them, can really feel like they're going crazy, fixating on this, especially when they are going to get, they get some feedback that things are fine. It goes back, well, then there must be something wrong with me. A common experience for a lot of these partners. What's wrong with
me? Right. Wow. Well, you know, backing up for a minute, is it reasonable to think that there's a chance, though, that sobriety will lead to better treatment of a partner? I mean, what do you think?
I certainly hope so. I expect so. And then when that is not the pattern, you really have to get curious and go, well, something else, something's going on here.
Yes.
Something's going on here. Because I absolutely would hope that women would expect that sobriety would lead to better treatment. And when that's not the case, those are some big red flags of going, what's going on? And sadly, I do see that. Sometimes even sobriety leads to worse treatment, like you were talking about. Sometimes the dynamic is such that there's an attitude of, okay, I've done the work I needed from the addicted partner. I've done the work. Now let's focus on what your issues, where you're wrong. And there becomes a very harshness or criticalness or a demeaning of her that may have existed prior and then comes back. Like you said, the pattern is, it comes back. He'll focus on himself for a little bit. Sorry. I'm slipping into those gender roles again, but it can be either way.
Sure.
And I'll confess what I work with women. And so I will very easily slip into those gender roles. And I know that's not always the case. So
please, that's okay. I appreciate that. Yeah. So, you know, I want to repeat back what I hear you saying, because I think it's really good and really important. Hopefully our expectation is, what our desire is, that with sobriety comes improved dynamics within the relationship, that recovery of integrity has an effect not just in the sexual realm, but emotionally and relationally between these two people. If that doesn't happen, I think what I hear you saying is we need to get curious about what else is going on.
Yes.
That there's something else going on. What is the something else? What could that be?
There's a lot of potential things. I mean, commonly what I will see, I'm particularly tuned into control dynamics, and these are often harder to spot if there seems to be attitudes of entitlement from the one partner to the other. And a lot of emotional abuse is what I see a lot of, sometimes even more the physical abuse. And I include in that when fear or intimidation is being used to manipulate or to control a partner, I consider that a form of physical abuse. So what I typically do is I get curious in all different domains of, I'm going to say, if I'm working with a woman, of her experience. So I look at what are things like physically? Do you feel safe with your partner? How are they sexually? Is there a healthy sexual dynamic? And that certainly is complicated when there's a sexual addiction, past or present. So that can take a lot of time to break down. I look into the psychological and emotional. I look into financial. I'm always fascinated to see what patterns, the way that a couple engages financially, reflect, and they often reflect other dynamics within the relationship. If there is an inequity in how the partnership engages with money and the value that the partners see that they are adding to the relationship. If there's an imbalance of one person feels that they're just so much more valuable in a sense, and they're entitled to more, therefore, that plays out oftentimes in how they engage with money, if there's a lot of control dynamics in money. So it helps, it's an interesting lens to see what else is happening in other domains. Again, I said the emotional, psychological, that certainly can, when there's an addiction present, that can and will, often does, impact those domains. But there are certain things that you see in those domains that aren't always because of a sexual addiction. They are, and like you said, when the sexual addiction gets, for lack of a better word, cleared up, or get their sobriety and recovery established, you should see largely in those emotional psychological domains, a return to healthy intimacy, or at least that respect. Now, sometimes couples need some coaching to get to that. What I'm finding, though, is some couples never had it. And it wasn't because of the sexual addiction. And so there isn't a return to it. There's a return to, as you alluded to more of the, maybe the covert or the subtle demeaning, silencing, belittling, criticizing of a partner. And then I look at coercive control often to see, are those, and again, a lot of those elements are more covert. They're not as acute as you think of when you have this discovery or this disclosure where your whole world crashes down in an instant. So we think of that as trauma, and rightly so it is. But these other things that happen in a relationship are also trauma when there is these really destructive patterns that essentially build in over time, and they're subtle enough where oftentimes people don't recognize them, but they are traumatic and they do prevent the healing for the individual and the relationship. And that's what I try to encourage women and couples to look at is what else is going on in the relationship that might be contributing to the issues that you're experiencing. Right.
Wow. You said a lot of really good stuff in there. So I'm going to pull some pieces out for us to reflect on a little bit further. I want to mention four words that I heard you say a couple of times. Okay. And these are some pretty big words, not big as in length, but you know, powerful words, abuse, control, power, and entitlement. Mm-hmm. And my experience is that people are very sensitive when this subject comes up. When I bring it up with a couple, right? There's a lot of defensiveness. I've even seen betrayed partners move to protect the partner who did the betrayer. Right. Mm-hmm. Because it's almost like they fear implications here, but I think we should just talk about these things. So when you say abuse, what do you mean?
There's a loaded question, isn't it? I have had the same experience. This is a word, a topic that we shy away from. And isn't, I find it almost a little funny since we talk about sexual addiction and all of like these very vulnerable things. And yet when we talk about abuse, it's a hard place to talk about. It's a hard place to look at. Whether you're on either side of this, it's a hard place for a therapist to sit with. And so for all of the people involved, these are conversations we typically want to avoid, and we will do a lot to try to do that. And I think that's part of the reason that it goes unrecognized and unaddressed. I want to speak just really quickly to that. It is so common for a woman who is being abused to protect, to minimize it, and to actively protect her partner, who is actually abusing her. It goes counterintuitive, but that's the more common pattern. So when, to your question, when I talk about abuse, typically I have a really broad definition, and that is when you are doing harm to another person, either intentionally, although I want to speak to it, it's not always intentionally, but through some sort of covert means. Usually there's a pattern. And another easier way to think about it, when we talk about abusing, if we take it out of the realm of human beings and say, you abused your car, you abused something. Sure. Usually you're alluding to the fact that you're misusing that, or you're doing something to cause it damage. You're not treating it as you should. And again, from a very basic perspective, we can apply that then to human beings and saying when you're misusing someone, and usually that's the underlying theme that I find, is I'm taking advantage of someone else at their expense for my gain, usually through covert means, or the misuse of power in the relationship. And in looking at it through the lens, it makes abuse something that I don't want to make it common or normalized. It's not. There is a boundary between normal human relationships have a lot of space for people to get it wrong and to make mistakes. And we need to preserve that, that humanity in our human relationships, to give people permission to be less than perfect and to do things that hurt each other. That's a guarantee. When you're in a relationship, right, you're going to hurt the other person. You're going to be hurt in that. And that's not abuse. That's not abuse. But so the distinction is often when you are deliberately stepping out of that, I'm trying to engage with this person the best I know how. And you go into a realm of, I'm allowing myself to use this person. You use the word entitlement. Oftentimes that's a big attitude that you find. I feel like I should be able to. I don't know if I answered your question or if I just added more mud to this. It's a hard one to really break down.
No, I think you did. It is a hard question. I knew it was when I asked it. I wasn't expecting a short, concise answer because it is nuanced and it's complex, and it's worthy of getting some space for those complexities to be examined. And I just had this conversation, I think, last week with some clients who were here in my office that, to own that some of my behavior was abusive, mm-hmm, doesn't mean I am like an abuser, full stop. That's the full sum of my identity.
Yes.
And I would even say that there's a scale, a range of, right here. And there's a difference between someone who is a characterological abuser, meaning like these abusive patterns are deeply, deeply ingrained in their personality at these very, yeah, fundamental levels, very antisocial, if we want to get clinical about it, versus someone who has their own traumas from childhood and their own defense mechanisms and their own. And I'm not saying that to minimize the effect of those patterns, but it's a little different animal. At least that's what I've run into clinically in my office.
Yes. A tool that I developed that I feel is helpful here when you're trying to break down abuse. I use something called, what I call the three lenses. And so when you're trying to get clarity on what's real, what's happening, if you're looking through a glass, if you imagine three lenses on top of each other. And so I call them my three eyes, and that is intent, interaction, what is the actual interaction, and the impact. And typically we get really caught up in the intent, and we can sometimes not move beyond that until we feel like we have clarity. about the intent. And I typically, when I'm working with women, I encourage them to flip that and start with the impact and say, okay, how are you impacted by this? And really get clear on that. And that will help to inform their further discovery as to, okay, these are the impacts you're experiencing. Let's essentially backtrack through history and look at what are the interactions and interaction patterns that are leading to these negative impacts. And then we get curious about that. What are the patterns here? What's going on? And then there, I believe it is valuable to look at the intent, because there is a lot of reasons. You talked about childhood wounding and childhood trauma. There can be autism spectrum sort of things, lack of skills that can lead to patterns that are destructive in a relationship. But that doesn't negate the impact. And so starting with that and giving women permission to get, create safety, just like we would when we're working strictly with the sexual betrayal, create safety from destructive patterns. And then from that relative safety, look at, okay, how do I understand my partner better? As I believe we're in a work that, I mean, we're dealing with people and humanizing this work and all who are involved in this is really important to remember and to come back to. It's one of the things I like about our working with sexual addiction and how they've done a wonderful job at humanizing those who are struggling with an addiction as human. And then there is a path, it's understandable. There's a path for their healing without negating the destructive impact it has on the partner. If we can take that same kind of lens with abuse, not asking women to tolerate it or men, because it works both directions, but to apply some of those same principles of, again, start with the impact. How are you being harmed? This can be harder to unpack sometimes, creating safety, yes. And then looking deeper about, okay, how does this inform my schema of my partner? Is my partner one of these people who are, there's a spectrum of awareness of, are they doing this for the intent to control or to harm? Or are they doing this subconsciously because it's a habitualized pattern they developed for coping with the trauma of their youth? There's so much variety in this, but you don't have to have the answers to those questions to be able to say, hey, what is happening is abusive to me. It is destructive to me, and I can respond and then get more information.
Yes, thank you so much. And I want to ask you, this is a sincere question. As I just think through how I work with my own couples that I see, and one of the things that I will do is, as we get into this conversation, yes, I do think it is important to talk about those destructive patterns and really get up close to them, right? Examine them. Do those conflict autopsies where we go back, we looked at what happened there, what went on. But it's not enough to, I don't think it's enough to say it's the man who's doing these, abusive patterns, to say, stop doing that. Mm-hmm. Stop being abusive. Stop, right? But what's the opposite of that? And for me, the opposite is mutual empathy and mutual empowerment. Right. So can you, do the basics of empathy, which that could be its own episode. But the empowerment piece particularly is what came up for me, because you talked about entitlement. You talked about the, power differentials, control. So if it's abusive for me to take choices away from my partner, I withhold a piece of reality from my wife. Therefore, now she's not able to choose according to a full understanding of reality, right? Okay, well, the opposite of that is to empower her to have all the information to make as free a choice as possible. Like, to me, moving in a positive direction is a lot easier than just saying, don't do that thing right there.
Yes.
Don't do that pattern. Well, what's the opposite of that? Well, empathy, empowerment. Would you add anything to that list? Would you tweak that in any way?
You're speaking of essentially when you're working with the partner that is committing the abuse.
Yes.
How do you essentially right. educate them out of it?
Educate and support, coach.
Yeah. This is where I'll confess. I think this is why part of why it's hard for therapists or those who work to do this type of work. It is an uncomfortable place sometimes to go into. It depends on, to some degree, their intention. If this is at a pattern, and I think getting clarity, and this is where you start, and you alluded to this, getting curious about where is this person coming from? Why do they do this? There is a big difference between they choose to do this because they like the benefits of it and they don't really care about the impact on their partner. That is a real thing that happens.
Sure.
And
yeah.
There's a very different individual who does this because it's the only way they know how to meet their needs. And they don't really understand that it's having the impact or as much of an impact on their partner as they would. They had poor modeling. And so, yes, in those cases, bringing their awareness, and this is the uncomfortable place of bringing their awareness to, is this hurting, this is how it's hurting their partner, and helping them, coaching them to be able to sit in that reality is going to be key. Can they really see yes. what it's doing to their partner? I guess that's the empathy piece that you talked about. And then I think it can be invaluable to work with them to some degree separately. Your betrayed partner or your abused partner is going to be looking for clarity on oftentimes the question of, are they really willing to change? Is this important enough to them? Now, what sometimes happens in these patterns is they get a little bit of coaching around healthy, and then they use that to further or more in a more sophisticated way manipulate their partner.
Right.
And so right. being really clear on what is happening from as a clinician, what is it, and judging, I know that's a harsh word in our field, but judging, is this person open to this message or are they looking for further ammunition to continue the patterns they want? And sometimes you yeah. have to kind of split these people up to say, this is what I'm seeing on both sides. And then empowering that woman, you use the word empowering her to feel free to respond to the truth that she's learning. And sometimes I know with couples work, traditionally there is a model of the client is the relationship. And so we prioritize the client, right? Which means prioritizing the relationship. Our goal is to keep these people together. And sometimes when you are in these type of dynamics, that is not serving really either partner. It's certainly not serving the victim of that. And it's not right. serving the person who's supposedly currying the benefit either. So sometimes you're right. going to need to prioritize the well-being of the individuals in order to be progress made. And that's a judgment call when you're working with couples that way.
Yes.
I don't know if I answered your question at all.
So You did. Thank you, Kim. So let me ask you this now. Let's say someone's listening right now and they're thinking, wow, is this me? Is this my relationship? How can they assess for themselves what's happening in their relationships? What are some questions or some things to look for to start thinking through? Are they describing me? Are they describing us?
That is a really long answer. That is the question. I designed to answer that question and assessment here several years ago. But it's about 168 items long, so I'm not going to read those. What I did to do that is I went through, again, those domains, and I tried to pull out, and I got a lot of feedback from really trusted colleagues and people who have been working in sexual addiction for some time, pull out patterns of interactions. And certainly this isn't completely comprehensive, because there's way more than 168 ways to experience mistreatment. Sure. What it does that I like is it defines some more of those nuances. Is this happening? Is this, it both from a positive sense of, this is what a healthy relationship looks like in general. Are these things happening? Yes, no, sort of in between. It's a Likert scale sort of thing. And then these are common unhealthy patterns. Are these things happening? And they're specific questions that you can go through and then try to pull out those patterns to see where the score is and where some of maybe those unhealthy patterns exist. The other thing I did with this is I went to a number of sexual addiction and betrayal trauma experts, and I said, of these items, the unhealthy patterns, which ones do you directly tie to sexual addiction? So for example, when a partner is into pornography and the other partner doesn't like that, I directly tie that to sexual addiction. It's an unhealthy pattern that causes issues in the sexual domain, but that's directly related to sexual addiction. So I gave those assessments to these experts, and I said, which ones are tied to sexual addiction? Which ones are directly tied to sexual addiction? Which ones are common with a sexual addiction, but often require additional skills training or some additional help, support, psychoeducation to help them to really fix? And then which ones indicate or indicative of something that is not at all sexual addiction? So it would mean there is a comorbid issue that is being looked at. So if your partner holds you down or screams and yells and throws things around the house, breaks your things, that's not because they're a sex addict. That they may be a sex addict, but that means there's something else going on as well. So there's just a lot of exploration involved. And I think being willing to ask a lot of questions about a lot of different areas and get curious and bring out those patterns is going to help you to answer. So I wish I could give you just those three questions that you ask to say, is this me or not? I would say, if someone is listening to this and this is resonating, I would say, trust your gut. Mm. That would be the one question I'd ask. Yes. Is this feels like it's landing somewhere, then lean into that and get further curious. If you're like, nope, this is not me, then trust that too. And skip this episode, go to the next awesome episode Jake has put out.
Thank you. I think that's super helpful. I appreciate that so much. And what a cool assessment. I would love to see that. Kim, if folks want to reach out to you, get in touch with you, how could they do that? Let folks know if there's anything you've got going on that they might want to be a part of. Let us know how they can find you.
Sure. My email address is kim@lifechangingservices.org. You can reach out to me that way. I also, from this assessment, I developed an online resource called Safe Space, and it's designed, and I apologize to you men who are like, this is me, I'm in this destructive, abusive relationship, but it is for women. It is exclusive for women. But if you are a woman or you know a woman who this is resonating with, or you think this would resonate, this is resonating, would resonate for, it is designed to help women process their own reality and make sense of it, find these patterns. It has a lot of worksheets that have some of these type of questions so they can ask these things of themselves. They can record their answers. There is a private podcast that I talk about a lot more of this with a colleague of mine, Amy Woolsey, who we both experienced this, both the sexual addiction and the abuse in our marriage. And so we have a lot of fun just talking about it, just from a very real, we've been there sort of way. So there are also a lot of just small little content pieces of how to empower yourself. I love that you pulled that word out, Jake, because that's one of the keys for me in creating this. Yes. Is how do I empower women, one, to see what is real, and two, to know how to respond to that. So that is at www.onesafespace.com, and I'm sure you'll put more info if you're curious about that.
I sure will. We'll have all of those links in the show notes, but just in case someone's, you know, audio only here, one, like yeah. O-N-E or the O-N-E, number one?
Safe, S-A-F-E. Now I'm going to test my spelling and talking at the same time, space, S-P-A-C-E.com. Yep.
Yes. Wow. That sounds like a really amazing resource. I'm glad to know about it.
You can also access that assessment.
Kim, thank you so much. Oh, okay. Awesome. Kim, thank you so much for coming on Betrayal Recovery Radio. It's been a pleasure. It's been a good conversation. I know that our audience will get a lot
thank
out
you.
Of it.
I had a good time.
Thank you for the work you
thank
do.
Thank you, Jake. I appreciate your time. It was nice to meet you.
Thank you.
Thank you so much for tuning in to this episode of Betrayal Recovery Radio, hosted by Dr. Jake Porter. If you value the content we've shared today, please feel free to rate, subscribe, and leave a review. This helps others find the show, and we greatly appreciate it. For more resources, visit appsats.org. That's APSATS.org.